finished at 10, 44 in Kenosha, 43 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little bit later in the hour, we will be giving you the promised interview with science fiction writer Sylvain Nouveau, talking about his latest book, Until the Last of Me. But in part one of today's program, we're talking about a wonderful play that is being presented this weekend, and actually this weekend only, at the Racine Theatre Guild. It is a wonderful play called Aquila and the Bee. And the word bee in the title actually refers to a spelling bee. And it is the story of a gifted young woman who is excitedly preparing for the National Spelling Bee, despite the objections of her mother. And this is a production that just about opened in the spring of 2020 when you know what occurred. And those plans had to be radically changed. And so it is with a very exceptional sense of relief and gratitude that Aquila and the Bee finally comes to the stage of the Racine Theatre Guild. We have with us in our studios the director of the production, Kara Ernst-Schalk, and we have Sanaya Carter, who is one of the cast members who is part of this. Sanaya is an eighth grader at the Real School in Racine and is making her stage debut in this production of Aquila and the Bee. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi.
Good to have you here. Good to have you here. So, Sanaya, you're off on break all week, which is why you're not at school and you're free to come to this interview. So thank you for not sleeping in this morning and joining us today for this conversation. It's good to meet you.
You too,
So, Kara, first of all, tell us about how you came to know this play and if you had a hand in the Guild deciding to present Aquila and the Bee.
I was aware of the movie. To this day, I still haven't seen it. I try to avoid that kind of source material, movies and other productions, when I'm producing something, just because I want it to be authentic to our actors and our space. So I'm looking forward to, in the next week or so, watching the movie after we've closed. But I was definitely aware of the story. I was definitely aware of the movie. in producing children's theater, I read a lot of plays. Some of them will work for the format that I usually work in. Some of them don't. I stumbled across this one, and I think I might have passed it on to someone who was on the play reading committee, but they also, I think at that point, had also found it as well. So it went to play reading, and I think that they had said that, you know, in the past, our outreach show for the spring is usually a little bit trickier to choose because we have to appeal to both adults and kids for our outreach program. But this one was actually one of the first ones chosen when the play reading committee read it. They just knew that it was a story that would work well for our space. It would work well for casting. So it was really kind of cool that it was one of the first chosen in the season 2 years ago.
Right. And before we talk about the story a little more, let's talk about the story of the spring of 2020. So explain to our listeners where you and your cast were in the process of mounting Aquila and the Bee, and then, in a sense, what happened.
We were just over a week out. We were about to enter tech rehearsals where we start loading in the set, working on lights, costumes, putting all of it together in that final process. So the cast was basically ready to go. They were off book. They were ready to start adding those last few features. And then COVID hit, and our assumption was we were just going to shut down for a few months, maybe remount in the summer, get it into the next season if we had to at the very latest. But we were ready to open. But everything went into storage, literally. I had all the costumes in my basement. Jill, one of the, or the props designer, took all of her props home in bins. And then the set was stored offstage, waiting, hoping that we would someday open.
Sanaya, what do you remember about the spring of 2020 when this decision had to be made that after all of those rehearsals, you weren't going to be able to perform this after all, or at least not when it was scheduled to be performed? What did that feel like for you and your castmates?
I think we're all like really upset about it. And I remember we were like all in a line and we like to talk about it, like what would happen. And we were all like hoping that'd be like in the next few months, like Kara said. And then a few months turned into a few years.
Right. And I'm sure you started wondering, I mean, are we ever going to be able to do this? And this part that you probably had super enjoyed preparing, were you ever going to get a chance to do this? So so tell us about when you found out that the Guild was going to do this again.
Oh, I was so happy. My mom, she was like, Sanaya, Sanaya, come here. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, go find your script right now. I was like, for what? And she's like, oh, it's going back on. It's going back on. Rehearsal start this time and this and this. I was really excited, mainly to see everybody again.
All of your castmates. So very, very good. So she must have seen a news release or something in the paper or email that with the happy, happy news. So, Kara, what kind of carryover do we have in terms of the young people who had been cast 2 years ago versus the cast we will see this weekend?
As far as the young people, we have the majority of people back. One of our young cast members graduated, went off to college. So he was unable to join us. But he's been sending me texts through the process and he, you know, wishing everybody luck and hoping that the play goes really well. Some of our actors who returned, especially our young actors, had an opportunity to re-audition for new roles.
Oh.
And so they've kind of shifted. And then we brought in just a couple young performers to replace a few people that were unable to come back. And then for our adults, we had about 50% be able to come back. But of course, with conflicts and life changes so much in 2 years.
Right.
So we miss all of our former family members. And we're definitely thinking of them. But we are so excited about the new people that have come in, joined our family, and just bringing a new life and energy to the production.
Fantastic. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kara Ernst-Schalk, who is director of the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Aquila and the Bee. And with us as well is Sanaya Carter, who is part of the cast. And can I assume Sanaya plays Aquila? All right. So we're especially glad that you can be here to share your perspective on all this. So, Kara, maybe you could summarize the essential storyline of Aquila and the Bee beyond the real brief description that I did at the outset.
Sure. Akilah is a middle school student in Southside Chicago. She is in a relatively low-income urban neighborhood and school. And we find out very quickly that she is a very intelligent young lady, and she excels at spelling. She grew up with her dad spelling and doing crossword puzzles, so she has an affinity for words. And it isn't necessarily seen in the school as something to look up to. She's teased mercilessly by her friends. The principal of the school, though, sees a special spark in her and pushes her into spelling and spelling bees. And her mother doesn't quite understand the bee culture. As she says a little bit later in the show, you know, I thought this was just kind of some board game you were doing, and doesn't realize that huge national surrounding of national bees. So it's Akilah kind of finding her way and trying to find people to support her in this passion that she has, because we do find out that her father is no longer with the family. So she meets some new friends along the way, and it's very interesting how both sides, their worlds are just completely opened up because of the new environments, new people, new friends, new neighborhood, new family. Essentially, everybody becomes a family. So it's just kind of worlds opening up on both sides.
Wow. Well, speaking of worlds opening up, Sanaya, as we said earlier, this is the first time you've ever been in a play. Can you tell us a little bit about what prompted you to even go audition for Akilah and the Bee?
My mom, definitely. She texted me one day and she was like, "You want to do this like stage acting thing?" And she told me about it. I was like, "Sure." Like, I didn't have high hopes that I would like even get casted, and you know, here I am. And I remember, like, we had, like, a little study group of, like, me and some of the fellow cast members that are in the play now. And I was just, like, so scared for auditioning. And, like, I saw the people. I was like, oh, my God. And, like, I saw amazing people out there. I was like, oh, yeah, see, I'm definitely not getting picked. And here I am.
Yeah, so you don't know everything, do you? You were wrong about that.
Yeah.
That's great, and happily so. So this is great. So you tell us now your take on the character of Akilah beyond what Kara just spelled out. What is she like, and how do you relate to Akilah? I mean, do you have some things that you share in common?
Akilah is super fun. She has, like, a little bit of a wall, so, you know, you just got to get to know her. She could be, like, super nice, super playful, has a bit of an attitude problem. But, you know, it's just like a regular 11-year-old, except she knows how to spell really good.
Yeah.
So.
What do you mean by an attitude problem?
I think you got to see for yourself, but it's kind of bad.
Okay, so she's a strong personality.
She's built up a wall to protect herself.
Ah.
And it's a very effective thing to keep yourself safe, is to build up that emotional wall when you're not quite sure how you're going to interact with someone you don't know.
Right. Fair enough. So has spelling, Sanaya, been any kind of significant part of your life, or only with this play?
Only with this play. I am so bad at spelling. Now, grammar, I'll correct you on your yours and yours. But, you know, other than that, I'm not the best at spelling. So.
Well, I'm sure you're a little better now than you were, I suppose. Huh?
Definitely.
And, in fact, how hard do the words get in the script?
They're pretty difficult. Some of them, adults, a lot of us are teachers in the real life, and we looked at the words and had absolutely no idea. So we're looking at dictionaries and pronunciation guides to make sure that we know how to say it. And I was preparing for this show. I actually looked up some of the former script spelling winning words from the past years. Some of the words in our show are much more difficult than what some of those winning words were.
Wow.
So it's pretty impressive.
You have a favorite you want to share with us, Sanaya?
Staphylococci. That one is so easy. I like got it down packed. Like, okay. I could spell it super fast.
Can you spell it for us?
Staphylococci.
Oh, my. Like poetry.
So
tell us about your castmates. It sounds like you are a pretty tight, close group.
Oh, my God. My castmates are like all my siblings. I don't know what I would do without them for, like, my quick changes and my props. They're just, like, there for everything. like Riley and Amina, I don't know what I would do without them. Mm. Amina is like a super amazing friend. And then Riley, Sanaya, we don't change here. I'm like, oh. I don't know what I would do without them.
Mm, that's cool. So do we have other newcomers to the stage that are part of this cast? And what kind of interesting challenge is that for you as the director?
We do. We have, well, the nice thing is we have, I love seeing new faces on the stage, whether people are experienced or not. It is so fun to bring new life and new energy. So we've got a lot of newcomers to the stage. Some of them have a lot of experience. Our Dr. Larrabee, he comes from a vast theater experience of directing himself and acting. So it's wonderful to have just kind of that solid stage presence on the stage. And he's a hoot off stage. So he's very different from his personality on stage. So it's great to have him kind of adding some guidance and leadership and just that solid presence. We've got a lot of familiar faces. And then some of our newer faces. Again, they have no theater experience, but it's amazing just the amount of honesty that brings to the stage. There isn't that preconceived notion of acting. They just come out on stage and put it out there. And it's lovely to see just that interaction of new, experienced, inexperienced. I don't think our audience is going to know the difference. It's very interesting how they've melded together.
That's really, really cool. And I'm assuming, I've not seen the movie, I am assuming that this is at its heart a feel-good, inspiring story. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Is there a kind of a moral of the story as far as you're concerned?
I don't know. Like, I guess there could be a couple, like, have that, like, close friend group of yours that, like, not go with, like, whatever you say, but, like, that is, like, nice and genuine, that puts a nice and genuine smile on your face.
Right.
That, like, makes everything seem right. And, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like this is a tribute to that. And also of making new friends and kind of reaching across divides of one kind or another.
And I think there's also this idea of a lot of times all of us go through life with preconceived notions of what we think of people or areas. And this is, I think the play starts us out in these preconceived notions, but we see the underlying story and context and reasoning behind all of our characters, which is so nice. So some of them start out as familiar tropes, but they aren't left in that caricature phase. We see the humanity behind all of these characters that we walk in and we think we understand. And then all of a sudden we start to see more information behind who they are and why they do what they do.
Wow. Nicely said. That's great. Well, I'm tremendously excited to see Akilah and the Bee, and we want to make sure people understand that for the public, it is just this weekend, the single weekend of performances, Friday night, 7 o'clock, Saturday, 2 performances, 2 and 7, and Sunday, 2 performances, 2 and 7. And then I'm delighted to see that there are a couple of outreach performances as well on next week, Tuesday and Wednesday. And that must be exciting, too.
It is. We're bringing in school groups, as we usually do. I do want to stress there are still some openings for schooling groups and possibly public if they're not able to attend this weekend. We do encourage you to call the Racine Theater Guild to set up if you are interested in participating in those daytime performances Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. There are still some seats available. So don't let last minute changes stop you from contacting us.
Great. And so one way or another, we hope everybody hearing this is going to want to see Akilah and the Bee. And at the Racine Theater Guild, of course, you can go to racinetheater.org or you can call 633-4218. And connect with the box office where somebody helpful will be happy to assist you. Kara Ernst-Schalk is the director of this production, this long-awaited production of Akilah and the Bee. And at the head of this cast, Sanaya Carter. Sanaya, are you hoping to be in another play after this? I suspect you've just scratched the surface.
Definitely. To make new friends and... Definitely.
Well, what an exciting way to start with Akilah and the Bee. Thank you both for being part of the morning show today. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having us and supporting the Guild.
You're listening to the morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes, I have the pleasure of speaking with a tremendously talented and innovative author by the name of Sylvain Nouvel, who has given the world some of the most intriguing science fiction novels to be written in the last few years, although that really is a simplification, oversimplification of what he creates. He likes to blend genres, and he certainly has done that in his most recent series, which is called Take Them to the Stars, which began with a history of what comes next and continues now with a second novel called Until the Last of Me, built on a really fascinating premise, which we will explore in a few minutes, on how did we ultimately, that is we meaning mankind, begin reaching into space. And he creates a fascinating scenario in which mysterious figures, generation upon generation upon generation, were actually behind mankind's slow but steady reach for the stars. And that is what he explores in these most recent novels. The second novel in the series, Until the Last of Me, has just been published by Tom Doherty Associates. And Sylvain Nouvel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to be talking with you. One of the interesting things about your background is that before you began earning your living as a published author, you had what we could probably describe as a checkered job history, or colorfully varied, or however you want to put it. But you know, we get the sense of somebody who was kind of bouncing around from one possibility to another, and a lot of them seemingly not to have a lot to do with each other. So it almost looks a bit random, and also like a really exciting, interesting life. Sketch for our listeners what I'm talking about, and then I'm really curious to know what kind of lasting impact those years of your early adulthood have had on you in terms of the writing you're doing now.
Yeah, there is a certain randomness to it. I mean, I was pretty good at school, probably too good for it to, I don't know, motivate me. And I dropped out of school. I was 15. Can't believe my parents let me do it. But I started working, and I guess, if you can think of a job, I probably did it. I worked as a journalist, as a photographer. I sold furniture, ice cream. I traveled a lot. I worked in soil decontamination. I did just about every job you can think of for about a decade. I was mostly going with the flow. There was no really like end goal to it. And eventually things were like, my salary was going down. So I figured I'd go back to school. I did a BA. I came back to Montreal. I did a BA in linguistics. And then I was going to go back to work because I couldn't live on grants. And my teacher said, well, if you apply to the U.S., like American universities, they might pay for your studies. So I said, okay, where do I apply? He said, well, pick any school you don't think you have a shot of getting in. Those are the ones you want to apply to. So I said, all right. I was accepted at Yale and the University of Chicago. Ended up doing a PhD in linguistics in Chicago. And I came back. Now, this time I had purpose. I was going to teach linguistics, but I couldn't find a teaching job. So I got a job as a software engineer in Montreal working on translation software. And somehow I ended up starting a translation agency for that company. And, you know, I'd been writing all my life. None of it, you know, had, well, some of it actually sort of helped pay the rent. Like, I wrote training manuals, worked as a journalist, as I said. But I'd never written fiction. And I started writing this book for the fun of it, as an excuse to build a toy for my son, my first novel called Sleeping Giants. I wanted to build him a toy robot. And my kid, instead of just saying, yes, Dad, please, just started asking questions, you know, what kind of robot, what does it do, does it fly, does it have pilots? So he wanted a backstory for the toy. that ended up turning into a novel for adults. Yeah, when I was done, I thought, you know, this is pretty good. I could probably publish that. So I sent it to 56 agents, I think. They all turned me down. No one wanted to read that book. But I figured, you know, what the hell, I'll self-publish, sell 20 copies. It's an excuse to write the second book, and so I can sell 10 copies of that, and write the third one and sell five. But I wanted it to look professional, so I sent it to a literary magazine called Kirkus, and they loved it, and they published a review online, and I started getting emails from Hollywood producers of all people, one and two and three and four and five, and they all read it, and one of them said, I think you need help. You need a movie agent. So he hooked me up with this guy at Creative Artist Agency. I talked to him on the phone, and he said, if you say yes, I'm your agent. I'm like, all right, yes. So I hang up, tell my wife I have an agent at Creative Artist Agency, and we think it's the funniest thing ever. It's like nothing will come of that, but it, you know, makes the week interesting. And but no, he called me back a week later and sold the movie rights to a major studio and said, you know, are you hell-bent on self-publishing? I know this agent, book agent in New York, the agency he works at represents John Grisham. And so I talked to this guy, and he says, you say, yes, I'm your agent. So I say, yes. And again, we're kind of laughing because nothing will come of it. But no, a week later, he calls me back and said, your book is auctioning, and we got four of the big five at the table. And a few days later, I had a three-book deal and a movie deal, and my life had changed completely. It happened in like a month.
Pretty amazing. Those rejections, the way you frame that is that as far as you know, those 56 book agents to whom you sent Sleeping Giants probably never even read it. I mean, is that the impression
Most of them, I know didn't read it because you can't send the whole book right away. So you send like a sample or a description. Then they can request some of it or all of it if they want to. And I think like two of them read it and the two turned me down.
Right. So at any rate, it's not that they were looking at this book and thinking it was terrible. It was just you didn't know how to open the doors to enter this world, which, of course, even when you somehow get your foot in the door, that doesn't mean your book is going to get published. It's exceedingly difficult. But ultimately, of course, you were successful. And I know we're not here to talk about Sleeping Giants, but I absolutely love the premise of it. Just briefly describe to our listeners this kind of backstory of the robot that you were building for your son, kind of the background of the main premise of Sleeping Giants. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it begins with an 11-year-old girl riding her bike through the woods, and she sees some light coming out of the ground somewhere, and she walks over, and the ground falls beneath her feet. She wakes up in a big hole, surrounded by glowing symbols in the palm of a giant metal hand. And 17 years later, she's part of a team that is scouring the earth looking for these giant metal body parts, trying to figure out where they're from and, well, if they can turn into something. I won't spoil anything saying they do. You know, this creates all sorts of problems politically and just bad things happen. You know, so the first book is more of a treasure hunt looking for these giant metal body parts. And in books two and three, we deal with the repercussions of that discovery on everything from religion to politics to everything.
So this becomes ultimately a trilogy, I think, called The Themis Files.
Yes. Called The Themis Files. Book two is called Waking Gods, and book three is called Only Human.
Excellent. Those are books I want to seek out. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with author Sylvain Nouvel, and we are going to begin talking now about his most recent book. It is the second in what is an intriguing series called Take Them to the Stars. It began with A History of What Comes Next, and this second book just published is called Until the Last of Me. As I indicated, this, like that previous book we were just talking about that became a series, has built on a really intriguing premise about how the human race was ultimately able to reach to the stars. And it's a premise that suggests that perhaps we didn't do it on our own in the way that we sort of think that we did. First of all, flesh out that central premise a little more, and then we'll explore how you came up with it.
Yeah, the series, Take Him to the Stars, follows 100 generations of mothers and daughters, all genetically identical for reasons, who have been messing with our history for over 3,000 years in the hopes of nudging us towards the stars so we can, well, so the humanity can escape our impending doom. The first book, called The History of What Comes Next, it follows Sarah and her daughter Mia, the 99th generation of those mothers and daughters, at the very beginning of the space race, at the end of the Second World War. They participate in the beginning of what will end up being called the space race, trying to influence everyone to sort of accelerate the process and get us to the stars faster. The second book, Until the Last of Me, is set in the 70s and 80s, and it follows Mia, who's now the mother, and her daughter Lola as they go on some type of quest or treasure hunt, looking for clues about their past and who they are and why they are like they are, while being chased by some very, very bad people.
Did that idea pop into your head for any particular reason? I mean, it is so out of the ordinary. I just love it. And I just wonder, can you attribute that light bulb going on over the top of your head to anything in particular?
Fish. I wanted to write characters that could span like centuries, millennia. I didn't know sort of easiest way to do it is to make him immortal, but I didn't want to write exactly the same character over and over again, and I have no idea how it would feel to be like 8,000 years old or whatever. So I was looking for another way of doing it. And then I read about this fish called the Amazon Molly. It lives in Texas. And the female of that fish tricks males of other species into mating with her. And then she passes on all her genes and none of the males to her offspring. And so in the end, all those fish are female, and they're genetically the same fish. There are no male Amazon mollies, and if you pick one at random, you look at it, it'll be exactly the same fish as the one next to it or another one. And I thought, this is amazing, because I can have my cake and eat it too. I can have characters that sort of self-clone for as long as I want, who are in some way the same, but at the same time, these women are born at different times, they live different lives, and they're influenced by their environment and become sort of their own person. And it has just opened the door for all sorts of explorations. I mean, you know, many of us try to become our own person and not turn into our parents, but it's a very different process if you're a genetic copy of your mom or dad. So that sort of started this entire process going, and then turned into a series called Take Him to the Stars.
And you just answered what was going to be my next question, which was, why is it that you chose these mysterious figures, 100 generations, to be women? And it sounds like it's because of this strange fish in Texas, and it is the female of that species that do as you were describing. So I assume that's why you then sort of carried that through to the central premise of your book.
Yeah, there are males with similar features in the series, but their reproduction cycle is a little more complex because it involves having a mother for a while, and we explore that in this book that just came out, actually. what influences the bad guys just by the fact that they have to go through a different type of life. For the women, they call themselves the Kipsu, by the way. They do need to get pregnant at some point, but after those 6 minutes or so, whatever, they can live their lives, just mother and daughter. Whereas the males who are chasing them, well, have to be raised in an actual nuclear family and have a mother.
One of the intriguing features of these novels that you've already touched on is, although they focus especially on more recent decades, and your first novel begins between the First and Second World Wars, when, in a sense, the space race really began, there are ways in which, of course, the space race was well underway before that, even though nobody would have called it that or knew where all of this was heading. But, you know, in a sense, you are also suggesting to us kind of the building blocks that eventually took us to what we think of as the space race. What kind of challenge was that for you in terms of understanding that yourself from the outset, and then trying to shape the novel in such a way that that it really does span history, including decades, even centuries before what we think of as the space race actually beginning?
Well, I have an academic background, as we discussed, and so I love research. So, it's difficult. Like, it's a lot of work, but it's something I enjoy tremendously. In my first series, I'd done research on, real world, like actual current world things, like from politics to how does a nuclear submarine work and whatnot. For this series, while I knew I was going to have to learn about rocket science and some, physics and whatnot, but since the series sort of spans 3,000 years, I knew there were going to be flashbacks to previous iterations of these mothers and daughters from 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And so I had to learn about the beginnings of science and astronomy, which is fascinating because, studying the stars when you don't know what a star is a completely different experience. But I got to learn so much. It was like one of the most fascinating things, looking at just the history of our knowledge of what's beyond the clouds. It's amazing.
One of my favorite moments in the most recent novel, Until the Last of Me, concerns the discovery of the planet Neptune and how it is, in a sense, almost discovered and not quite, and then eventually is discovered by one Johann Gottfried Galle in September of 1846. And you describe Galle as the first person to look at the planet Neptune and know what he was looking at. In other words, there were people before him who, while looking through their telescopes, saw Neptune, but they didn't know it. They didn't know that that fuzzy little dot amongst all the stars was, in fact, the planet Neptune. And it's
Galileo saw it.
I suppose.
He's like the first person who could have seen it, and he did twice, but he didn't know what he was looking at.
Right. And, of course, that kind of helps us think about the whole business of scientific knowledge and discovery and breakthroughs, and the fact that part of the long and complex process of discovery includes that very thing of things, phenomenon, objects, whatever, being seen, being observed, and yet not in the moment understood or identified until sometime later. And I should think that really becomes wonderfully fertile ground for what you're exploring in these novels.
Oh, absolutely. The nature of knowledge itself is super interesting to explore. For a while, we knew the Earth was the center of the universe, and everything else revolved around it. And then we didn't know it anymore. But a lot of things we discovered along the way were based on that premise. I mean, there's a ton of science that was based on this notion that the Earth was at the center of everything. And some of that knowledge actually survives today. It stood the test of time because it didn't sort of depend on it. But yeah, it's interesting to look at what it actually means to know something. And since these characters are, that's their whole lives, the pursuit of knowledge is what they live for. And they get to question to sort of very concept of what it is to learn something.
Right. In one chapter in this novel, one of your characters, it is the mother of someone named Emily, apparently had a saying, and there is such truth here: knowledge is like spring. It will surely arrive, but it will do so in its own time. And I guess that's part of what this is also about as well, even with these mysterious figures trying to move things forward. Knowledge only advances so far, and we have no perfect control over what that advancement will ultimately look like or feel like.
Yeah, there's a quote somewhere else in the book. It's actually from Cory Doctorow, but I don't name him because he wasn't born when the scene happens. But it says, when it's helicopter time, you get helicopters. When it comes to inventing things, we think of it as like, oh, one person did this, but it's not. It's like the entire sort of universe conspiring to get to that through a million other different things.
The book is a really interesting mix of genres and also a mix of formats. That is, from one chapter to the next, the book looks really, really different. First of all, explain to our listeners in a little more detail what I'm talking about, and then explain what's behind your choice as the author to shape the book in this, in a sense, unpredictable format.
Yeah, I've always had a thing for different formats. My first series is epistolary. It's pretty much in, like, 100% dialogue. There are a few chapters here and there that are like journal entries or things like that. But it's mostly documents that describe dialogue that happened between two people. In this series, I tweaked it a little bit. So you during most of the chapters, you're in one of the characters' heads, and you hear their inner monologue as well as the dialogue they have with other people. But then you get to these I call them entr'actes, between the sections where you have flashbacks to previous generations, and those are written in a third person with a more traditional narrator. I like playing with format. For my first series, I liked the idea that the book itself sort of actually meant something in the story. It was a collection of documents that existed. And in this particular case, I wanted the contrast between those flashbacks and what these people are going through to be super apparent, because from the outside you can look at it and say, oh my god, these, you know, it's amazing and they're super badass, but at the same time they're struggling, they're trying to figure out who they are, what they want, and questioning why they're doing what they're doing.
Exactly. And of course that's ultimately what draws us in to the story. I'm also intrigued by the fact that you make the choice, as a history of what comes next begins, to not make everything clear right off the bat. And in some ways, you don't ever really just spell it all out just in an instant. And so the reader is, you know, can kind of in an instant realize, oh, now I understand what all of this was about. I mean, it is really an experience of slow and steady discovery by the reader to kind of sort out what is going on here, and who is this person, and why are they doing and saying what they are. What do you think about as the author in terms of kind of shaping the book in such a way where you want the reader to be intrigued and yet not so bewildered that they close the book and leave it. I mean, I think you've achieved exactly what you want, but I wonder what you thought about in terms of achieving that.
I like, you know, I was talking a minute ago about how I like the fact that my first series, the book itself, a physical object, actually exists in the story. But I like to create parallels between the book world and the real world of the person sitting and reading it. And in this case, the characters lost the knowledge of who they are, what they are, and why they're doing it a couple thousand years ago. And I wanted the reader to sort of share that lack of knowledge and discover things exactly at the same time as the characters. I wanted the reader to want to know in exactly the same way as the want to know. I hope it works.
I think it really, really does. And again, this latest book in the series, Take Them to the Stars, is titled Until the Last of Me. And before I let you go, I want to ask you briefly about a really intriguing blog post of yours that I read on your website, which was titled All the Lost Magic, Publishing in the Pandemic, in which you talk about something related to this period of the pandemic that I'd never stopped to think about, and that is that in all of the kind of the fuss of everything going on and all the information being disseminated and spirited discussions sometimes giving way to kind of ugly debates, there is a danger that some really cool things were sort of lost in the shuffle. And I think you're talking in particular about really great, interesting books published in this period that maybe never got a fair hearing. Can you just say a word about that and what prompted you to want to write about this in your blog?
Yeah, I mean, it's you get mixed feelings, right? Because so many bad things were happening. People died, right? So you can't compare, you know, book things to people actually dying. But through all that, like, every book, if you put it in front of the right person, the right pair of eyeballs, it will be that person's favorite book. Doesn't matter what book it is. And that happens usually through where you need people to do that. Word of mouth works, but bookstores are usually the way to go. They get people to discover books that will be their favorite books. And you know, bookstores were closed for a while. After that, we had everything from, you know, everything was happening. The news cycle was absolutely crazy. There was very little room to talk about books. And so many, many books went unnoticed and will never sort of get this privilege to do their magic and be someone's favorite book. And, you know, it affected me in some way, but I had a career before. But there are like tons of debuts, people who worked like a decade on something, and finally they got, you know, they got a book deal, and it takes probably a year and a half, 2 years to get published. And so, you know, they were waiting for this, and this was their beginning, the beginning of their career, and it just, in a snap, that was gone. That's it. It's over. And I think it's tragic. And if there's one thing I would encourage people to do, is to go to your favorite local bookstore and ask whoever's there to show you a debut that came out during the pandemic. Discover something that a lot of people have missed. Mm.
Very nicely said. I think that is terrific advice. And in the meantime, we want to again remind people about the latest book from Sylvain Nouhel. It is Until the Last of Me. And it is from his Take Them to the Stars series. Sylvain Nouhel, it's been great to make your acquaintance today and talk with you about your career and the really intriguing and innovative books that you have crafted and shared with the world. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
It was a pleasure.